It's 1 o'clock, and let's begin to give plenty of time to our speaker and to the question and answer period that follows. Dr. Will will be hosting that. Great to have you here at the beginning of the Norton Lectures. They date back to 1914, at the very outset of World War I. They were endowed by George W. Norton, so we have a 97-year-old tradition here at Southern. It is a great honor to introduce Jean Bethke Elstein. I've read her everywhere, and I have a tiny piece of paper to introduce her. If we introduced everything, if we had the paper to cover everything, a whole acre of Canadian pulpwood would have to fall to publish that. I'll read just some very simple things. She is the Laura Spelman Rockefeller Professor of Social and Political Ethics at the University of Chicago Divinity School. She has authored over a dozen books and over 600 scholarly essays and articles, and I think I've read at least a sixth of them. I am an adoring reader. Her most recent book, and I see that we have discount coupons there, her most recent book is Sovereignty, God, State, and Self, and these were her Gifford Lectures delivered at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. You may know in philosophy that William James delivered Gifford Lectures and was the first to do so. But in that tradition, you have such philosophers as John Hick and Alasdair MacIntyre and John Dewey and Alfred North Whitehead. And it's an incredible tradition. I believe Reinhold Niebuhr is one who's delivered lectures there as well. And so she's in that tradition. Among her many honors and activities, she's a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. She holds the McGuire Chair in Ethics at the Library of Congress, and she has served on the boards of the Institute for Advanced Studies at Princeton University and the National Humanities Center. In the past, she's also served on the President's Council on Bioethics. That was with Leon Cass, was that right? Yes. And again, as I said, she's delivered the Gifford Lectures at the University of Edinburgh. I'll add this. My daughter, Kessid, was a graduate student in political theory at Georgetown University and had Professor Elstein in a class on American political thought, I think it was. And I talked to her the other day by phone and said, you're never going to guess who's coming to campus. And I mentioned her, and she says, oh, she's my favorite teacher. It was the most wonderful class. We read the greatest stuff. And she says, that was the best experience I had there. And she said, we even read Davy Crockett. And I asked today at lunch, and yes, indeed, they read Davy Crockett and the Bostonians and a variety of other things. But she is a scintillating teacher, a great writer, and a delight, and what a privilege it is to introduce you. Professor Elstein, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm delighted to join the people who have been at this podium before me and to be part of this great tradition of Norton Lectures. Before I begin, I want to say thanks to President Moeller, who just took off for the airport, but I got to meet him at lunch, Robert Sagers, Daniel Patterson, Russell Moore, and Katie Murphy, who did a lot of the arranging for this occasion. Now, before I begin, I would ask you, if you would, a personal favor for me. When you're saying your bedtime prayers tonight, if you would remember in your prayers our daughter Jenny, who is going to have surgery tomorrow. It's pretty routine stuff, but anytime you have surgery, it's an issue. So her name is Jenny, and I think God will know who she is if you just say Jenny. I'm pretty sure that will do it. So that would be wonderful if you could do that. Thank you for that. Now I'm somewhat the title of the lecture and the lecture itself are a teeny bit at odds, because as I was finishing this up, I went a slightly different direction. But I think it's a fair enough fit that rather than spend time sort of telling you what I've done differently, the best thing is just to start. And I should give you a sense in general that what I will be doing is talking about the issue of how we think about our bodies in our historic epoch, about the coming of new modes of genetic engineering, and the promise on the part of some that we will become entirely different sort of post-human entities at some point. Contrast that when I go to my second lecture this afternoon with biblical images of healing, and then tomorrow talk about some of my own personal experiences as someone who had polio as a child and the different ways in which society has thought about those who have bodily infirmities of a certain sort and how they in turn engage society more generally. So with that as a sort of overview, let me begin. I want to share with you first a typical experience that I have. I'm delivering a lecture on the political implications of what is happening in the world of biotechnology, including so-called germline engineering, which is deliberately altering the DNA of an egg so it is forever changed. And the way in which it is altered is then what is transmitted thereafter. Now, at one point shortly after I begin, I note the danger we are in, that we face, from a certain sort of fundamentalism. And heads nod up and down vigorously. And of course, the audience is thinking about some awful right-wing Christians who want to stifle science. But when I go on to speak of genetic fundamentalism, I am greeted with dropped jaws and heads nodding no, and an atmosphere that's chillier than it was but moments before. We want to condemn certain sorts of fundamentalists, but us, we're not fundamentalists. How dare she? Well, let's think about this for a moment. How dare I put fundamentalism in the same sentence as genetics? Well, I want to explain to you what that's all about. Now, it goes without saying that there is considerable background to fill in so that I might persuade you, if indeed I do, that the locution genetic fundamentalism is apt. And the architecture of my remarks for this lecture is as follows. First, I'm going to take the measure of the landscape, describing briefly the enthusiasms and obsessions of the present moment where DNA and its possible manipulation is concerned. Then second, I'm going to raise a series of critical issues and claims about genetic triumphalism, drawing on historic evidence about the treacherous nature of biopolitics. And finally, I'm going to offer some thoughts on the interaction between science and society. For science is never isolated in an apolitical realm. For example, those who claim that one side to the embryonic stem cell debate has politicized it, but they insist they don't want to do that. They believe science should be free to do its job without political interference. When they make that claim, they are really trafficking in nonsense, because they themselves, of course, are stating a political position. It would be far more honest to state that my convictions invite a politics of embryonic stem cells that differs from those who object to cloning, because that's how we get embryonic stem cells, in order to generate embryos that are then destroyed or harvested to garner stem cells. It is really nonsense to say that one side believes in science, whatever that means, and the other side does not. And it's also very dangerous to believe in science without critical ethical reflection and restraint, as history surely teaches us. Science is never simply unleashed, but always deployed towards certain ends and purposes that tend to reflect in important ways the wider culture within which science is nestled. Now, we in America and in the West more generally have passed through a number of stages of biological obsession. In the 20th century, the stage most relevant for our concerns is eugenics. But before I delve into that sorry tale, I will examine briefly current projects of self-overcoming via genetic manipulation. These projects are tricky to get at critically because they present themselves to us in the dominant language of our culture, the language of choice and consent and control, and because they promise an escape from the human condition into a realm of mastery. Now, we are readily beguiled with the promise of a new self, it seems. And as we seek cures for the human condition, the desperate edge of that seeking bespeaks the conviction that our imperfect embodiment is the problem that must be overcome. So one premise that drove the Human Genome Project was that we might one day intervene decisively in order to guarantee better, if not perfect, human products, thinking of human reproduction as an analog of production. We'll get a better product out at the end here. Now, I don't intend to issue strictures against any and all attempts to intervene in order to forestall the development of devastating and treatable conditions or diseases. There's a huge difference between preventing an undeniable harm and striving to create a perfect human specimen without blemishes. Now, claims made by genomic enthusiasts tend to run to the ecstatic. We are bombarded with talk of designer genes, G-E-N-E-S. Do you want a blue-eyed, blonde-haired, strapping youth with athletic tendencies, perfect teeth, and a 75-year warranty? I exaggerate, but not by much. Note that an advertisement that appeared throughout college newspapers a few years back read as follows: intelligent, athletic egg donor needed. Large financial incentive. You must be at least 5'10", have a 1,400-plus SAT score, possess no major family medical issues, $50,000. Now, as the journal Commonweal noted in an editorial prompted by this advertisement, it brought back eerie reminders of earlier advertisements that involved trade in human flesh, and suggested in the editorial, we are fast returning to a world where persons carry a price tag and where the cash value of some persons is far greater than that of others, end of quote. Now, some responsible scientists have suggested slowing down, noting that all the early hoopla about genetic intervention to cure sickle cells, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, Parkinson's, all of that has come to naught. Trials with gene therapy have been marred by poor results and, in some cases, death. Yet the GenTech industry in the United States proceeds apace, largely unregulated, making all sorts of promises, often cruel promises, that it cannot keep. But even if it could keep them, how should we think about such efforts? Forestalling disease is one thing, genetic enhancement is another. And with genetic enhancement, you start with a healthy person, and then you promote the genetic equivalent of cosmetic surgery in order to make people taller, thinner, more attractive, more athletic, higher IQ, and so forth. As scientist Doris T. Zallin has pointed out, genetic enhancement enforces certain societal prejudices. And she adds with considerable understatement that the historic record on all of this sort of thing is not encouraging. Right. Now, just last year, and this is through the clumsy method of abortion that we're told, you know, one day we won't need that, we'll have other ways of dealing with these things. Just last year, the New York Times reported 32 million missing women in China, fewer women than there should be, based on the ratio of births of male and females, 32 million missing women brought about by the crude method of post-sonogram aborting of female fetuses. A reminder of where an unrestricted abortion right leads, where a strict one-child policy prevails. So even in the absence of such a policy, all the evidence we have suggests that abortion for sex selection tilts in favor of males. Now, several kinds of responses to these sorts of activities, to a kind of lust to dominate, as St. Augustine would call it, run amok, are possible, and I cannot rehearse them all. Suffice to say that those within the scientific community, the calmer voices, are often drowned out by the din of the genetic fundamentalists who truly believe that genes tell all, as they do in a 1997 film some of you may have seen called Gattaca. Now, in that film, the antagonist, played by Ethan Hawke, is born the old-fashioned way. This is called a faith birth. His parents made love, and they took their chances with what sort of offspring might eventuate. They weren't licensed to have a child at that point. And in this new world, when a child is born, an immediate genetic profile is done. Now, just as an aside, let me say this, and then we'll go back to the film. We're now doing this prior to birth. Once genetic screening was only for conditions that could be treated once discovered. And the objective, as the President's Council on Bioethics, on which I sat before we were all given our walking papers when the new administration came in, the President's Council on Bioethics, in a report called The Changing Moral Focus of Newborn Screening, which is a report issued in December of 2008, we pointed out that the benefit for the patient guided genetic screening. It was to try to see if there were some dire conditions that could be prevented. And there were treatments, known treatments. Now, however, states test for conditions that are not well understood and for which no treatment options exist. Treating for some 29 primary conditions is now routine, with 25 secondary conditions also tested as well. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis is increasingly deployed in order to decide whether or not to destroy embryos, based again on certain presuppositions and probabilities. So imagine being a parent and told your child tests positive for 8 conditions, all of them rather mysterious, none whose course is predictable. Indeed, most will likely not manifest themselves at all. The parent's entire attitude toward the child changes. Apprehension, fear, replaces hope and encouragement. So we've got some of this genetic, this panoply of genetic testing now of a very problematic sort. Let's go back to the film. This young boy is born, and his genetic profile is completed. And young Vincent, that's his name, turns out to be a beautiful child, but he is considered genetically inferior on the standards of the world that he inhabits. Among other things, he has poor eyesight. So he enters life not amid awe and hopefulness, but misery and worry. And his genetic quotient is coldly read off by an expert who says, cells tell all. Now, because of his genetic flaws, because his was an unregulated birth, young Vincent is not covered by health insurance. He does not get to attend school past a certain age. And he is doomed to menial service. He is called a degenerate, an invalid. Now, we're not in this nightmare, of course, but are there straws in the wind? Are we getting close? And certainly on the insurance front, we may be. There's some issues that have come up about people testing for certain possibilities and insurance being withheld or not, as the case may be. And we are close, I think, in our method of evaluating people from time to time whose lives are deemed somehow more worthy than others based on certain genetic or biological possibilities. And that was the entire thrust of a previous period in Western history when biogenetic obsession drove cultural norms and political policies. And that was the era of eugenics. Eugenics was the attempt to control nature by controlling the sorts of people who are permitted to become part of our world. Now, that would seem to fly in the face of norms that we embrace, like the moral equality of persons, and indeed, this is the case. Yet societies that either proclaim that moral equality explicitly, or whose commitment to human rights assumes such a grounding for rights, raced with alacrity to embrace eugenics. Now, we know the story of National Socialist Germany, of what happened under Nazism with this eugenics program. We do not know well the story of what happened in our own and other Western societies. In America, for example, eugenics was part and parcel of the American birth control movement spearheaded by Margaret Sanger. In 1920, 23 of the clergymen, scientists, and physicians listed on the National Council of Sanger's American Birth Control League were also involved in a prominent level in eugenics. And on the public policy level, this group agitated for compulsory sterilization of those deemed unfit and for immigration restrictions to weed out the less worthy, Jews, Slavs, people from Southern Europe, and so on, Italian Catholics. And they were successful, by the way, in getting through these immigration restrictions. The eugenics craze came to a head in the now notorious case of Buck v. Bell before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1927. This case, by an 8-1 vote, allowed that the state of Virginia was well within its constitutional rights to sterilize a single mother found, quote, feeble-minded. Her name was Carrie Buck. She was 17 years old. She was unwed. She was pregnant, and she had been raped. Now, Carrie Buck was locked up in a state that permitted involuntary sterilization of marginalized citizens, all in the name of producing the best genetic projects, inviting superior genetic material to reproduce and stopping inferior genetic material from doing any such thing. Well, it turns out that nearly every claim made about Carrie Buck and other women in her family, nearly every claim was false. The reigning idea was that imbecility was hereditary, that you could measure imbecility somehow. She was declared imbecilic by experts, some of whom had not even examined her. Yet Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes pronounced with the great confidence that pro-eugenics progressives displayed, and eugenics was carried by the progressive movement. They were using the best science. They were very confident. This is what he says in the decision. It is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. End of quote. And the New Republic, which was the great organ of the progressive movement, in an editorial in 1915, was responding to a particular case that had become public, and there was a great stir about it. It was a Catholic social worker who objected to euthanizing a deformed newborn child. And the editorial indicates that the argument by this Catholic social worker that had been picked up by some of the newspapers demonstrated the dangers of, quote, dogmatic scruples when they're posed against science. And the editorial goes on to say they're appalled that the refusal to keep a, I'm quoting, deformed idiot alive, that had become a moral issue throughout the nation, and concludes by saying it is always desirable to weed out the unfit. That's 1915. I should tell you, by the way, that I wrote an intellectual biography of one of the great figures in that era, Jane Addams, and she was one of the few progressives who opposed this sort of thing. John Dewey was a eugenicist. President Woodrow Wilson was a eugenicist, and so forth. Now, Sanger herself advocated sterilization of defectives, and that was part of the overall package that included immigration restriction, as I've told you. She was part of the then generalized fear that the lower classes and the inferior races were outbreeding the Anglo-Saxons and healthy stock more generally. So cultural, this is what's frightening, right? Cultural and ethical barriers to eugenics collapsed with astonishing speed. The Catholic Church held firm against eugenics. Evangelicals of an Orthodox theological bent held firm. But liberal Protestants, who dominated the culture, went for eugenics with gusto. Why is that? They believed in science and found ways to deride criticisms and to celebrate eugenics as part and parcel of the American Eugenics Society's effort to generate a healthier America. And famous clergymen, household names, like Harry Emerson Fosdick, preached eugenics from the pulpit. Christian scripture was twisted into knots to support eugenics, including the Sermon on the Mount. Now, here's one example, and I think it's rather unintentionally hilarious, but it's frightening in its implications. And let me give you a flavor of this. Quote, eugenics compelled the biblical Good Samaritan, who stopped to aid the victim of a theft, to assume new functions. Once the Samaritan simply befriended the victim on the road to Jericho. In the early part of the 20th century, he would have provided better policing and lighting of the road to discourage thieves who prey on travelers, right? And now, the essay goes on, the Good Samaritan knows that his duty is to prevent those thieves from ever being born in the first place. So you have the changing admonition about what the Good Samaritan should be all about. That, of course, completely destroys the parable. To encourage eugenics, a Best Eugenics Sermon Award was instituted, a Best Eugenics Family of the Year was selected, and so forth. And the best book on this is by Christina Rosen, and it's called Preaching Eugenics, if you want to follow up on any of this. Well, eugenics, as you know, fell into bad odor given Hitler's biopolitics. Nowadays, we do not have eugenics, no one wants to use the term, of course, positive genetic enhancement as a politically endorsed policy. But again, there are too many straws in the wind to ignore. Consider that nearly 90% of Down syndrome pregnancies in the United States are aborted each year. And the idea is that we could become more efficient, and we could somehow genetically program Down syndrome out. It would no longer happen. We could become more efficient in eliminating this category of human beings from taking their place among us through more sophisticated genetics in the future, replacing the clumsy method of abortion. One mother of a Down syndrome child wrote to me after having read one of my pieces against genetic control. This is what she said. The function of prenatal tests, despite protestations to the contrary, is to provide parents the information necessary to assure that all pregnancies are normal. I worry not only about the encouragement given to eliminating a whole category of persons, the point you make, but also about the prospects for respect and treatment of children who come to be brain damaged, whether through unexpected birth traumas or later accidents. What about the pressure to which parents like myself will be subject? How dare you choose to burden society in this way? Now, that exchange was a few years ago, and this mother's worries have come to pass. We have documented cases of women being refused prenatal care by physicians who labeled them irresponsible for continuing a Down's pregnancy, said basically, find another doctor. I have witnessed cases among my own students who were subjected to intense pressure to abort by medical providers with dark warnings about how irresponsible they were to burden society and themselves by continuing this pregnancy to term. And during the last presidential campaign, some of the vile stuff about Governor Sarah Palin for having carried, whatever you think of Sarah Palin, in anyone's book, this should be awful, for having carried a Down syndrome baby to term, and then describing that baby as our perfect baby boy, a lot of that stuff was really unspeakable. And I think it alerted us to the rise among us, the rise of intolerance for the different. Now, Hans Reinders, who's a Dutch ethicist, has observed the irony of the present moment in Western democracies. We talk nonstop about access for those with disabilities, even as we frantically set about eliminating such people or finding ways to eliminate them through genetic engineering and abortion. And Reinders concludes one of his books by saying that parents of children with disabilities have every reason to be frightened about what is happening in liberal societies at present on this issue, that their fears are not misplaced. Now, genetic fundamentalism is one feature of what I have called in my latest book, The Sovereign Self. We see an odd combination of what I call excarnation. That is, we want to get rid of this body that we now have. It's less than perfect. We want to get rid of it. We combine that with a form of genetic obsession. We are our DNA, but we want it to be in a more perfect form, to exist in a more perfect form. And you might be interested to know that some people who resort to cryogenics when they die, they want to preserve themselves for the future when, you know, we can have solved the problem of death. Many of them have only their heads preserved. The body is sort of useless. What counts is the head. So the idea is, well, you know, freeze my head, and then some way down the road there'll be something they can attach to it so I can be up and about somehow in the world again, but with my mind, which is the essential part. I call that Cartesian decapitation, that only consciousness matters. Now, there's a quest for control here that's always been a feature of the sovereign self, one who has complete domination over nature, beginning with her own. So we find matter-of-fact pronouncements that we will inevitably begin to choose our descendants in direct ways, the kinds of descendants we want. And we're told that we now do this by permitting or preventing the birth of our own children according to their medical prognosis. The assumption is we all sort of do that. Thus, we select the lives to come, and we'll have the capability to more perfectly select those lives in the future, so long as society doesn't cramp our freedom of action. We will stay on the high road of progress and exercise sovereign choice over birth by consigning to death those with a less than stellar potential for a life not marred by an excess of pain and disability. Notice how loose this is, an excess of pain and disability. What is an excess? What counts as pain on and on? Isn't it likely that as we eliminate what no doubt nearly all of us would regard as a serious disability, we will begin to chip away at others that now seem not at all that bad, but will once their contrast models have been safely and permanently removed? Remember being in England last year, there was a big flap in the newspapers over a woman who had aborted because the infant was going to be born with a cleft palate. And there was a debate over whether that counted as a sufficient disability to justify abortion. Now, let me turn to science and society. As I already noted, science has become a political football. And as usual, the lines have been drawn in very clumsy ways. We have the pro-science camp. We have the anti-science camp, allegedly. And this, as I've said, is ridiculous, because the question is always, what sort of science and to what ends? For the so-called pro-science camp, science occupies a sphere immunized from debate and challenge and dialogue, from politics. The other, the allegedly anti-science side, at least understands that science is never immunized from the wider society, although we may very well object to how they propose to mix the two, but at least they understand that science isn't in a little perfect realm, a little cordon sanitaire, cut off from everything else. Now, why does the pro-science side enjoy the high ground in this debate? Why does it have the elite media on its side and all the rest? I suspect it is because science has become a kind of authoritative discourse. When science speaks, other voices are bidden to fall into respective silence, especially if those voices are deemed religious and therefore irrational, according to the pro-science camp. The trumping nature of scientific discourse helps to account, I think, for why creationists claim the mantle of science for themselves as scientific creationism, because they believed it was the only way they could get in on the conversation. I think it defeated their own concerns, if I may be blunt, but you can understand why they did it. Well, let's go back to a regime that called itself applied biology, namely National Socialism in Germany, the middle of the 20th century. Now, I do not intend to do what some have called an ad Hitlerum argument. You know, you can find something in Nazi Germany, and that's exactly where we are now. No, that's not exactly where we are now. But there are all sorts of instructive things that we can learn from that and continue to learn from that regime and that cultural experience. We can learn a great deal by exploring an order, a totalitarian order, in which scientific voices drowned out voices of opposition. Scientific voices were dominant. Scientific ambition run amok, aided and abetted by the state, a state enamored with evolutionary biology and the new eugenics. And they triumphed. In a fascinating text, Robert Proctor's award-winning book, The Nazi War on Cancer, we learn more about all of this. And the fact that the National Socialist State, if you didn't know it was the Nazis doing it, you'd say, boy, they're pretty progressive in all this stuff. In its approach to public health, they thought that they had to be responsible for every aspect of the well-being of the German people, from genetic manipulation to diet and exercise and all the rest. So the conventional narratives that treat the medicine of the Nazi era as one vast irrationality or monstrosity and call it pseudoscience, I think are not, Proctor says, they don't understand fully what's going on. It's true that they declared whole categories of persons life unworthy of life. They did that. But that was based on a whole notion of how you should sustain and support and benefit the health of those who were worthy of life. So the state took over full concern for the health of the German people. Nazi nutritionists stressed the importance of a diet free of petrochemical dyes and preservatives. Health activists stressed the virtues of whole grain bread and food high in fibers and vitamin. Many Nazis were environmentalists. Many were vegetarians, including Hitler himself. Nazi doctors worried about over-medication and overzealous use of x-rays. They cautioned against an unhealthy workplace. German doctors had established the link of smoking to lung cancer decades before public health officials in Western democracies acknowledged this fact. Smoking was banned in public places, banned in all city trains and buses in the spring of 1944. And Hitler personally ordered the measure to protect the health of young women serving as ticket takers. And an educational campaign blanketed the Third Reich with information and propaganda, urging pregnant women not to smoke for fear of harming the unborn child. Well, how are we to understand all of this? Did these measures run counter to Nazi ideology or in tune with it? Now, Proctor's account demonstrates that these health measures in that context, that was in perfect synchronization with the state's insistence on preserving and increasing the fitness of the already fit, or those with the potential to be. The unfit, as we know, were dealt with in other ways. Now, Germany at the time of the Nazi rise to power was the most powerful scientific culture in the world. It boasted half of the world's Nobel Prizes, along with extraordinary innovations in basic physics and engineering. They established the most successful cancer prevention program of the era. Nazis employed physicians on factory floors to oversee the health and safety of workers, even as they deployed physicians to make the selections at the death camps. Hitler declared that reforming the human lifestyle is far more important than anything else I might accomplish. Now, the bitter irony at the heart of the National Socialist public health campaign was perhaps most apparent at the Dachau camp, concentration camp, which became one of the world's leading producers of natural botanicals and spices. The largest medico-botanical research station in the world was maintained there, tended to by thousands of slave laborers who were literally worked to death. So those sort of considered human waste of the Reich, the unfit, were compelled to labor for the health of the genetically superior Aryan race. Now, what does all this add up to? The obvious point, it seems to me, the minimal point, is that relations between science and society are far more complex than is commonly imagined, according to Proctor. We need to better understand how the routine practice of science can so easily coexist with a routine exercise of cruelty. And cruel it was. The eugenics ideology in the most advanced scientific culture of its time established the Axion T4 program to kill the mentally and physically handicapped. They were the first ones to be gassed. And some minimally 200,000 children, infants, and adults were murdered by medical personnel, nurses, and doctors in asylums where persons with disabilities had been concentrated, the better to kill them. And this regime was a regime of applied biology in their own description. And to this end, they insisted, certain antiquated moral norms had to be quashed, had to be eliminated. And one of those was the sacredness of human life, and another was the moral equality of persons. We have to eliminate those because those are irrational barriers, right, that stop us from moving in a direction that would generate the most fit population and weed out the unfit. And it's just a bit creepy that this very same argument is being made today. We have to do away with old superstitions like the sacredness of human life. This is stated explicitly, for example, by Professor Peter Singer at Princeton, who says that's his life project, to get rid of that idea, the sacredness of human life, utterly destroy it. Now, one doctor during the Nazi era opined that to the laws of biology, all else must be subordinated. The science of our people on the basis of the Aryan biological value gauge has to serve their struggle for existence and the preservation of their healthy life and of the race, defining it in that it prepares and hands over as a weapon the fighter for what is important in the struggle of people for existence. So in this situation, what we saw was how easily people in science and medicine were suborned by dreams of glory and control and their ability to manipulate the fate of hundreds of thousands of people. We also see how alarming it is when ethical and moral barriers are eradicated and a naked will to power can take over in science and other spheres. And when this will to power is hitched to the power of the state, the 20th century state with its apparatus of control, that was horrific. And throughout the Nazi era, primary research in biology and medicine continued. In fact, it flourished until the end of the war because one could conduct experiments on live subjects without restraint, no ethical restraints. One could subject corpses to procedures that had previously been considered ill-dignified and forbidden. There were no restraints in what you could do and how you could experiment and who you could experiment on. Now, one important doctor, Carl Schneider, professor of neurology at the University of Heidelberg, celebrated the fact that perhaps the time had come at last when a researcher could exorcise the superstition of religious ideas and open the door to a richer life for the German people in harmony with its own particular powers and talents. This richer life involved the children's operation, which was carried out by the Reich Committee for the Scientific Processing of Serious Genetic Diseases, and it was intended to be a model of progressive health policy. So as early as 1939, this committee had introduced the compulsory registration of all malformed newborn children. And doctors and midwives received a payment if they reported instances of idiocy and Down syndrome, physical deformities, forms of spastic paralysis, epilepsy, and so on. So the idea was we can do away with all these outmoded legal codes and religious beliefs, and then we can really get to work. Now, back in the heyday of the eugenics craze, many in our own society openly admired this approach. The American Euthanasia Society put forward criteria for selecting those to be euthanized that mirror the criteria of deployed in Germany. The old, the infirm, the difficult, cripples, persons with retardation, and so on. A spokesman in the United States for the society, the Euthanasia Society, observed that she had some unhappiness, quote, with Nazi methods, but not with the results. In May of 1940, she's writing, Nazi doctors, quote, give the insane children of several asylums, gave them morphine, and then shot them. She added, of course, this is a great blessing, but it is too bad it had to come about in just that way, close quote. Now, we in the United States did not, of course, go the route of claiming entire groups of people were fit only for destruction, but we did sign on with the negative valuations of some by contrast to others. We were prepared to come up with our criteria for that. Fortunately, our tradition of law, democracy, the force of religious conviction for many made it possible to challenge and to slow down some of these developments, and then we could begin to see what was happening, the horrors that were emerging from Germany. But this should make us, we should not ignore the fact that the eugenics movement enjoyed many successes in the West until Nazi policy cast a pall over the enterprise. Well, let's leap forward to the present with the eugenics craze and its upshot in both Germany and restrictive legislation throughout the Western world in mind. We now have protocols in the Netherlands, for example, to euthanize handicapped newborns. Only, we are told, retrograde sentiments. That's a quote from the doctor who instituted these protocols. Only retrograde sentiments criticize such developments. So eliminating handicapped newborns fits right in with one modality of Western culture. It's one. It's not the only one, but it's one. Our obsession with the genetically fit, with beautiful, if not perfect, bodies. Now, what universe of, as I move to close here, this first lecture, what universe of ethical discourse is available to people in medical practice and research that might help them to sort out such matters? I can't spend much time on this here towards the end, but neither Kantianism nor utilitarianism serve very well, it seems to me. I trek over to the medical school at the University of Chicago from time to time and have a session with the medical students. They have to do a unit in ethics, and their ethics textbook, I've complained about it each year. It seems to be the same textbook all the time. But there are two ways of reasoning ethically. One is deontology, a type of Kantianism, and the other is utilitarianism. You would not know that there were other ways of trying to struggle with and think through these problems. Well, what's the problem here with those two ways of thinking? Deontology radically oversimplifies matters, it seems to me. By casting moral norms as categorical imperatives that, by definition, cannot conflict with one another. But of course, in the real world, including the world of medicine, we often have competing goods, not one thing that's awful and one thing that's good. That would make it really easy. But competing goods, and it doesn't help us sort that out, has almost no concrete connection to the world as we know it, where goods conflict all the time. Utilitarianism makes it far too easy to knock down ethical barriers if one can claim that the greatest good for the greatest number is at stake and will eventuate. Now, I cannot take time to describe an alternative, nor to say more about pro-science critics who treat all ethical opposition as irrationalism, often in a tone with contempt. But let me conclude. Anything involving science and its claims must be debated. Too often, bioethics today is an enterprise for the production of rationalized permission slips to the gentech industry. We find a way to say it's okay for them to do what they're doing anyhow. What we need is people debating how are we to order our lives together. Inescapably, the question of limits to what we are permitted to do is a political question. It's an ethical question, and it's a political question. We cannot remove such questions from the realm of political debate. Medical personnel and professional bioethicists alone cannot decide this question. So we live in a curious moment. Science continues to claim its sovereign right to no interference of any kind under the rubric of freedom, but our society, indeed any minimally decent society, has the task of setting limits to what science or any other group can do in pursuit of its goals. This does not mean blocking valuable research. It does not mean that just anything goes. We also live in a moment when the very idea of human dignity is under assault. This small, precious idea that underwrites human rights of the most fundamental sort. And we should all be afraid, we should all be very afraid when attempts are made to crush to bits those remnants of the sacredness of human life that we continue to cling to. So science cannot stand alone, medicine cannot stand alone, and I see three possible scenarios, the relationship between the two. The first option is when science and medicine are wedded to the powers of an omnicompetent state, and this combination is caught up in a will to power that mows down everything that lies in its pathway. That was the story of Germany, mid-20th century. A second scenario, science and medicine reign supreme in their own domain, and the state acts as a kind of enabler. It provides largesse, it provides funding, and the voices of moral and ethical constraint become ever more neutralized and marginalized. And I think that's the situation that we're in now, that we're moving into. Let me remind you again, science and medicine reign supreme in their own domain. The state does a lot of the funding and so forth, and voices of opposition are slowly sort of marginalized and shoved off to the side. And third, and this I think would be the best option if we could muster it, involves science and medicine and politics and the institutions of civil society, including our churches, in an ongoing dialogue about the nature of the political and moral universe. Science and medicine do not stand alone. Scientific discourse does not automatically trump every other way of thinking about human life. And that surely, it seems to me, is the path that a decent, human rights respecting, pluralist democracy should go. And it is that small, precious idea that every human life is of value. For we bear the imago Dei, we are created in the image of God. And any attempt to destroy this idea, to besmirch it, to deconstruct it, to negate it, serves as a catalyst for unleashing the will to dominate that leads only to murder and cruelty and despair. Now, in the second lecture, I'm going to examine some biblical sources on healing that offer, it seems to me, another way to reflect on our bodies and what it means to be healed. So thank you all very much. Thank you. Thank you.
Dr. Elstein has agreed to take some questions, and I know that there must be some, so please come forward to one of the microphones and ask your questions.
I'm ready. Got my pen.
While someone's coming, I remember in Michael Crichton's, the late Michael Crichton's book, State of Fear, he had an appendix to the book, an annex, where he recounted this folly over eugenics in America.
Yeah.
And it turns out that I think everybody from Harvard Law School to the National Institutes of Health to the state of California was on board.
Yeah.
And he was using it as an analog to a global warming confusion or something.
Yeah.
Are there other cases that come to mind where the entire scientific community is on board and it's just received knowledge and it's wrong, and it turns out to be wrong? Or is eugenics kind of the outstanding example of just widespread folly in the modern age?
Yeah. Well, I think eugenics is the major one, and it's the one that we know most about because of the horrendous consequences, real-world consequences that we saw. but people who do history of science, I know, could point us to some other cases where, you know, there's been sort of generalized scientific unanimity on a particular point or a particular way of understanding a problem, and then at one point there's been this tremendous sea change and people realize they were simply wrong about it. I mean, that was the whole burden of that famous book by Thomas Kuhn some decades ago on the nature of scientific revolutions, where you have the shift of paradigms and realize that, you know, what was an inescapable truth turns out not to have been that all along. And I can't point to some specifics there, but I think what that tells us is that we should always be a bit cautious, and we should always be humble in our embrace of science and its claims, which isn't to say there isn't truth there. It isn't to say there isn't solid knowledge there. There is, quite often, most of the time even, let's suggest. But to grant it a kind of absoluteness and to suggest that anyone who challenges it is some kind of maniac, an extremist of some kind, caught in the throes of irrationalism, is palpably wrong. And I think there's enough history behind us now to demonstrate that. And yet, we keep forgetting that history, or we don't know it in the first place. I find that most American students don't know anything about this eugenics craze in our own country, know nothing of it. And you had some of this eugenics legislation, by the way, on the books as late as the 1970s in the Scandinavian countries and elsewhere. So it was a very common theme. You know, it's easy to demonize Germany and to say, oh, look what they did there. Very common theme throughout the West. And they, of course, then under totalitarianism took it to the horrific extremes we saw. But it was widely shared.
I guess I was thinking when you were talking that it seems to me that eugenics and like sex selection and those kind of things are all attributes of like sort of a collectivist and statist mentality.
Yeah.
And what's absent there is sort of the individual rights and the rights of every man to his own life. I guess what I'm worried about is that if we go so far as to, you know, ban certain things like genetic enhancement, aren't we then like using those sort of collectivist and statist mentalities by using force in order to stop people from doing that? Like eugenics is force against the individual, but then, you know, we're turning around and saying you can use force to limit individuals' liberty in order to like determine their own genetic whatever.
Right. Well, thank you. Well, as you probably know, the American democracy is premised on a notion of ordered liberty with appropriate limits to human freedom, not just a system that was set up to generate and to sustain human freedom, but also to limit its exercise. So there's not just anything, you can't just do anything and claim freedom as support for what it is you're doing. That's never been true. So when we set a particular context within which people are free to act, and there are certain things that they are not free to do because they so deeply violate the underlying premises on which the society is based, that's not a blow against freedom. That's a way to sustain freedom.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is I don't see the clash between me altering my own genetics,
yeah,
and you know, like me causing anybody else any harm or damage.
Well, if you alter your own genetics, first of all, two things. Number one, you can't alter your own genetics.
Well,
it takes a whole panoply, you know, a whole establishment of people in biology and medicine and so on to do that, who have had widespread support as far as funding and so on for these efforts. Number two, if you alter your own genetics, you're not just altering it for you. You know, if you actually start to manipulate the germ line, so to speak, the DNA itself, you're permanently altering any descendants you might have in ways that nobody knows a possible outcome. So it's not just you. unless you intend to go off and live in the woods, you know, with the bears until the day you die. I mean, it's gonna, you know, it's gonna affect a bunch of other people.
So you think that we need to honor and respect the rights of people who don't even exist yet?
Well, I think that any society that embraces rights, and any society that is based on the premises that the United States Constitution calls upon us to embrace, is a society that is not simply present-minded, but one that is always mindful of the world that is to come and the world that we deed to our children or our grandchildren. So we do have some obligation to think about what that world will be like, what we will place before them, you know, what their lives will be like, and so forth. So I don't want to get into an argument about, you know, rights for abstract, non-existent. I don't want to get into that kind of abstract discussion. But simply that the horizon of one's thought cannot be exclusively present-minded. And it strikes me that much of what, alas, happens with some of the genetic enthusiasts and so forth is radically present-minded. There's very little thought, scant regard, you know, for what the implications of this might be over the long haul. So this is not just a matter of you making a choice about something in, you know, like a smorgasbord of life. You know, this is what's on that smorgasbord. Society as a whole always has some say about, and should, because each society makes some determinations about what kind of place this is, how do we understand our way of life together, and so on. And we, of course, can and should be find abhorrent, you know, some of the choices that have been made in the past and are being made now. And often choices, of course, that are made in a context in which people are pretty cruelly beaten down. But nonetheless, I think, you know, if I were you, I would examine some of my presuppositions about the nature of human freedom and the issue of the ways in which the moral community, in fact, always sets some limits to the exercise of that freedom in order to protect freedom over the long haul. Okay?
You had made the comment that in order to answer some of the problems that the questions that eugenics raises, you didn't think that the deontological arguments or the utilitarian arguments provided those answers. What ethical model or compilation models would you use?
Well, you probably had a sense there that what I would urge would be a serious engagement with the complex sort of body of ethics that we derive from Christian teaching, which it strikes me does not fit into either the deontological or the utilitarian grid in any precise way. And that if you do that, if you take a look at the bodies of teaching that have emerged from the scripture on down, both in the Jewish tradition and in the Christian tradition, that you find, again, very rich ways of thinking about persons that also understand situations of dire necessity. You know, when moral norms, I'm thinking here of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was the anti-Nazi German theologian who participated in the plot to assassinate Hitler. When he was writing, he didn't ever write up an apologia for that act or that attempted act, but rather talked about harsh necessity in a very cruel and desperate situation. So he was not totally governed by, you know, the deontological stricture against the intentional killing of another person, given his assessment of that situation at that time. So if we required him to adhere to a strict deontology, he would never have participated in that effort to rid the world of Hitler. But he understood, you know, you can stand before God as someone convicted of a sin, and he believed it was a sin, and yet, if you will, sort of plead the cause, you know, the case of necessity, and seek and know that you in effect need to do penance, even if it is Hitler. You know, need to do penance for this. So I think if we look at that, you know, if we look at the way in which this reasoning functions in these very rich and complex ways, we can see that it partakes of some aspects of what looks like deontology and some consequentialist dimensions as well, but it's neither of those in any pure sense. Far more complicated than that. And of course, what Christian moral reflection offers is a recognition that we are not isolates, you know, standing, you know, seriatim, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and so forth, isolated sort of sovereign moral knowers and choosers. But we're always born into community. We are sociable beings. And that what we do or do not do, what we are forced to do, punished for doing or not doing, all of that takes place in a social context of some kind. We're never simply isolated. And I think too much of contemporary ethical theory assumes this kind of isolated, you know what I mean, isolated chooser or knower outside the framework of any kind of social context. And it's not terribly helpful. It's far too abstract, and it doesn't get at the richness and the texture and the nuance of our sociability and of community.
Just a quick follow-up
question.
You mentioned then the stream of Christian thought with ethics. Do you think that something like a virtue theory or a moral theology would have anything to say to this situation?
It would. I think that the sort of working out or working through a virtue theory, a certain kind of teleological theory, would be of some help. Attempts have been made along those lines, you know, at least are starting along those lines. But that would be one way to move as you seek a richer alternative. Interestingly enough, when you look at these textbooks that at least the one that I know given to the medical students, that's nowhere to be found. You know, it's just these two systems, and you can see why they make the decision making lots easier, don't they? And if you start to put in these more complicated ways of looking that try to fold in a narrative, you know, some teleological dimension, it gets far more complicated. But you're right. That's a good. I should have mentioned that. Thank you for noting it for me. Thanks.
Thank you for bringing more attention to the eugenics movement here in America.
Thanks.
I think Edwin Black, I believe his name, in his book War Against the Weak.
Yes, that's a very good book. Yes,
he does a good job with it.
Yes, he does.
Showing how close it was even to where we are now in Eastern Kentucky and Western Virginia.
Yep, and the race dimension of it, and yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But my question is, in the three scenarios that you gave, of one where America could be heading and looking more, well, you didn't make this connection here, but of one more of a Nazi Germany society where science and government,
they collude.
That's right, and
yeah.
Bulldozing anyone that stands in
it
way.
Stands in a way, yeah.
And then number two, where you think we are now, I guess, where the government
Correct.
Has simply come alongside science.
Right.
Do you believe, just in want to make more of a practical question here, do you believe that the Obama administration and their health care plan, federal health care, do you think that pushes us more towards the first scenario then?
Well, it seems to me that the Obama administration in these areas has not been very helpful in its, among other things, various directives that have come down that have had the effect of sort of chipping away at the conscience exemption, for example, for healthcare providers, doctors and nurses and so on. Now, there are people who are working on some of the law cases that this is generating and so forth, who know the details better than I. But some of the rules that have come down through Health and Human Services, through his administration, really bear some unfortunate implications for the ability of providers to stand aside from engagement in certain procedures that they find deeply offensive and even sinful, a violation of conscience. And that, we can immediately think of cases, a Catholic doctor being compelled to perform an abortion, or a Catholic hospital being compelled to provide abortifacients, you know, and so forth. Now, we're not there, that hasn't happened yet, but the directives that have come down are inching that way. And the choice of Catholic hospitals at that point, should this come to fruition, if we run a worst-case scenario, let's say, would really be pretty stark. Either their board of directors would say, okay, we'll just go secular, we won't be a Catholic hospital anymore, or in other cases, they would say, we'll have to shut our doors because we're not going to do this. We're not going to engage in this, by definition, immoral, evil activity. And of course, the many thousands who would be harmed by that, they're the ones who would suffer, because the Catholic hospitals are the ones who stayed in the inner city, who disproportionately serve the poor. So that would be a very costly victory, would it not, for a certain kind of pushing of, you know, one sort of homogeneous model, if you will, on all healthcare providers, that includes the insistence that all of them everywhere, you know, must offer abortions and so forth, whatever their tradition and whatever their conscience objection. So that's a worry, I have to say. That's really a worry. And if you want to ask me some more later, I also think that, we're fine. We're fine. The way in which President Obama has reconfigured his Council on Bioethics, I think he's calling it a commission. I've noticed that what they're focusing on are sort of historic cases of things that happened long ago that are settled now. For example, took up a case of some American public health people who, with the active participation of the government of, I believe it's Honduras, did experimentations on live human subjects on venereal disease, knowingly infected people with venereal disease, to try out new treatments and so forth. And this is a chapter, you know, sort of people don't know very much about. And of course, it was horrible stuff. And it was the sort of thing that's been universally condemned and would not be permitted any longer and so on. Nothing really controversial about it. But it's sort of safer, do you know what I mean, to look at stuff in the past and say, oh, this is terrible, this is awful, and the president calls Honduras and says, we apologize for this and so forth. Easier to do that than to look at, you know, these issues that we face right now that are so divisive. And yet we need to model a way for people to have dialogue on these questions. And I think that the previous bioethics council, the way it functioned was really a model of how to do that, because there was by no means unanimity. And any report that was issued included a majority report and a minority report, and each individual member could write up a statement about their views on it and so forth. And yet people stayed in the room with one another, they debated these issues under a presupposition that there was goodwill on both sides. And we need more models of how to do that. And I think avoiding the issue is not helpful. So, yeah. Let's take one more. Yeah.
I would like to close as the time is closing.
Oh, okay.
If you're going to be here for the next lecture, are you going to be here for the next lecture?
I won't, but that's okay.
All right, we'll stay. We'll
okay.
Stay for a couple more minutes. Go ahead and ask.
Go ahead, go ahead. Yeah.
Well, thank you for being here.
Sure.
If we're going to engage the scientific community in dialogue,
yeah,
most of us are going to do so as outsiders, dramatic outsiders, and there's barriers to that. I mean, there's barriers of
yep.
vocabulary and of
yep.
personal credibility.
Yep.
So could you speak to how to surmount those barriers to
yep.
dialogue?
Yeah. Boy, you've really hit on a tough one, because there's nothing like the claim of expertise to shut a discussion down, as you know. And this happened to me when I attempted to have a debate with a colleague from the economics department at the University of Chicago, and it didn't work very well. I mean, because the assumption is I have a PhD in economics and you don't, and I know what's happening with economics and you don't, and therefore you have nothing to say to me. And I alerted him to the fact that he didn't know my subject matter either, and I probably knew as much about economics as he did about philosophy and various forms of moral teaching. So why don't we just assume each of us knows something and start talking? But that wasn't quite the way it worked. So you're really compounding the problem when you have the, you know, people with their, you know, their white coats and so on being very, very professional and medical and scientific. And I think there that what one has to do, and this is not an entirely satisfactory answer, but maybe it offers something, and that is to say, look, how dare I presume that I can engage in this conversation? Well, how about if we just say we're both American citizens concerned with what's happening in our country now and what it's going to be like in the future, and one area of concern is the area you work in, you know, and I, as a well-informed citizen, have some thoughts on this, and I think we should be able, in an atmosphere that is not one of harsh antagonism, a way to talk about these things. Now, that doesn't solve the problem of where you find the venues for this. And I think at universities, and attempts are being made at Chicago for this, to have a sort of medicine and faith programs, medicine and law, and, you know, bring people together. But you need one or two people to start those things up and get them going, where it really does try to bring people together who don't agree with one another and may not even know what each other is up to, you know, to think through these problems. But you're right, there is that high barrier to entrance into the dialogue. And there, you know, look, you're a citizen. You don't have to be an expert. You're a citizen, and that should be enough. Thank you.
Well, we will start our next lecture at 2:30. Let's express our appreciation, Dr. Elston.
Thank you. Thank you. See some of you then.